Play to Potential podcast.
Welcome to the third conversation in the Play to Potential podcast series. This is Deepak Jayaraman here, creator and curator of this series of conversations, where I talk to leaders across walks of life on topics around leadership, transitions, and careers. My guest this time is Captain Raghu Raman, a man who's reinvented himself several times over. He's had stints in three very different environments. He spent his initial decade plus as an officer in the Indian Army, with the government as CEO of National Security Grid, and with the private sector in leadership roles in Mahindra Group initially, and now with the Reliance Group. Raghu is a distinguished fellow at the Observer Research Foundation, a frequent guest faculty in schools, a columnist in leading publications, and an author of Every Man's War, published by Random House. Without further ado, over to the conversation. Raghu, thanks for your time. Excited to be talking to you.
Same here.
And I must say, before we dive in, I must provide a little bit of personal context. I grew up in the civilian world, like a lot of the other Indians, and with relatively no clue about some of the other parts of the world, like armed forces and government services and so on. And Army didn't even enter the consideration set when I was thinking about career options. But 13 years back, something significant happened. I married an Army officer's daughter. It was like a Ben Stiller and Meet the Parents kind of a moment. But I think, jokes apart, over the last few years, I've had the privilege of interacting with my father-in-law and really learning a lot about the war stories, quite literally, and in terms of what the corporate world and some of the other areas could learn from the armed forces. And I've heard you speak passionately on this topic in different forums, so I'm excited to be talking to you. Before we dive in, Raghu, would be great if you could provide us a quick background of your career path over the last several years.
So, well, I guess about three decades of work divided kind of almost equally between the Army. I was in the Army for about 11 odd years. That's my first career. The second stint was with the corporate sector, and largely again with one corporate, but doing different pieces of work in the Mahindra Group. Then I went back into the government, but this time I went back to Ministry of Home, which is literally and figuratively on the opposite side of Ministry of Defense. So, and I spent 5 years there as a bureaucrat, and then again I came back into the corporate world. So it's been a sort of an environment where I began was very authoritarian and very regimented, where you largely lead with elements of authority. And in the corporate world, as you're aware, the leadership is more in terms of material incentives. And of course, there is an element of... but the tools on which you rely are much more in terms of material incentives and financial gains and benefits. And then the government, where, again, the ecosystem and the environment is completely different, where there is actually no material incentive. You cannot... And there is a very highly developed sense of consensus-driven... ecosystem, where to get anything, like I often say that in the government, if you want to get anything done, it's like pushing a string. It's not like pulling a string. You need that kind of consensus. So, very interesting way, very interesting prism to see it from three different directions, and deepest of respect of each one of these professions once you see how easy or tough it is to get anything done in each one of those ecosystems.
Let's rewind the clock, Raghu, if it's okay. Give us a sense of how you got into the armed forces.
Well, I wish I could tell you that I had thought it through and all of that, but honestly, that's not the true answer. I was like many young people when I was young and I was in college. I was I used to listen to the last guy I'd talk to about my career options. So one day it would be a merchant pilot, another merchant navy, another airline pilot, then an MBA, whatever. Then I guess something did happen in my life, which was quite a seminal event, and I kind of decided to join the Army. And I must admit that the first few weeks when I entered the academy, I thought, you know, where I got stuck, because obviously your father-in-law will tell you that in the first few weeks they are slightly harsher because they want to weed out all these tourist soldiers who have watched a movie and decided to join the Army.
Saving Private Ryan.
Yes. Well, those days actually John Rambo and something like that. So, but within the first few weeks, I realized that this is what I was meant for. And I think to that extent, the Army is possibly one of the only careers where when you go through the process of the SSB, the Services Selection Board, they sense whether you have it in you or not. I mean, they evaluate and they come with a very accurate diagnosis of who you are, and perhaps much better. I don't think at that level, which means when you're in your early 20s, as an entry-level job, there is any other organization which spends 5 days in testing you physically, psychologically, emotionally, from an attitude point of view, culture point of view, leadership qualities point of view. And that's the kind of intensity with which your own diagnosis is done. So, yes, I guess that was sort of the start point into that life. And I had various different opportunities within the army. And there again, I would say that I was possibly one of the luckier ones to have served with different arms. For instance, I was commissioned into what is called the mechanized infantry, which to a layperson is more of tanks and light tanks, so to speak. But I had the opportunity also to do two stints. One was with an infantry battalion called the 12 Jackriff, 12 Jammu and Kashmir Rifle in Siachen Glacier. Completely different style of functioning in an infantry battalion, mountain warfare, a lot of learnings, going into a new environment, a new unit. And within 1 year, having to learn enough over there to command their respect or at least be tolerated by them, so to speak. Then I had another chance to go as a UN peacekeeper in Angola. That was again with another battalion. And my last sort of big stint with the army was as an instructor in the Armored Corps Center and School, which is yet another sort of armored, it's another arm of the army. So in the 11 years that I spent, I had a fairly diverse exposure. And that's when I sort of left from the army and joined the corporate world.
And just to understand it a little better, again, a lot of us end up spending the initial years focusing on acquiring the hard technical skills. And the notion of leadership starts kicking in much later in life. Army, in a way, like you said, from very early on, the sort of the principles of leadership start getting drilled in. So from an individual standpoint, I'm curious to get your perspectives on how should somebody think about a career in the army? Having spent 11 years, let's say if you had to talk to an individual who's at an inflection point, let's say 10th or 11th or 12th or the end of graduation, what's the perspective you would share in terms of how they should think about it?
So I would actually say a career in the army is possibly, there would be three drivers, and these aren't mutually exclusive. You can have all three, or even if you had one of the three, I think it should be considered as a serious career option. The first, of course, is if you are passionate about, serving in the forces and, wearing the uniform and leading troops, and that I mean, which other career gives you a chance to jump out of an aeroplane or take 16 tanks into the desert, or, all your foreign missions are, out of a plane, jumping out of a plane or jumping out of an amphibian landing craft or stuff like that. So that kind of a high, that kind of a thrill is no other career can, sort of give it to you. I mean, for people who stand on top of a mountain and look out and say that this is the ultimate goal of my life, or a view that I've ever seen. Imagine the fighter pilot who sees the curvature of the earth, who actually sees the sunrise over the curvature of the earth, not over a mountain or something. Or imagine any college kid who says that I want to drive a motorcycle, which is like, Harley Davidson, which is 100 horsepower. Imagine the honor of driving just one horse and sitting on top of it and escorting the president to the presidential dais and bringing him back. You can only do these things in the Indian Armed Forces. So there is definitely that piece to touch the limits of your own potential, whether they are physical, mental. If you go for a commando course, as I did, those 30 days and 30 nights, they help you discover yourself. They help you discover reservoirs of you, which you never know that you had. The bonds that you will forge, they are blood brothers. So like you have, probably in the colleges you have course mates. I mean, I was sort of a college, so I know what that means. But the moment you come out of the army, you have blood brothers. They are not course mates, they are blood brothers. So for the rest of your life, you just have to say, in my case, I just have to say 81st regular. And whoever is part of that course is honor bound to help me. There is no debate in his mind that whether he has a choice. There is no conditionality. You are your sworn brothers. So that band of brothers, that phrase actually goes back almost King Henry's time. He's the one who actually coined that phrase. And it is truly a band of brothers. So that is one driver. The second driver, I believe, is, as you rightly put, the fundamentals of leadership. If you want to learn how to take men into battle without ESOP, pay hike, employee of the month, or any other material tool, by purely your own personal leadership quotient, then that is again the only, and the stakes that you take them into, they are not about losing market share or a campaign goes wrong and you lose a key account. Here, if a campaign goes wrong, you make widows, you make orphans. So the stakes at which you are being taught leadership at an age of maybe what, 20, 21, you are holding the lives of sometimes up to 100 men in your hands. Now, to my mind, when you are learning any lesson, whether it's leadership or otherwise, the key differentiator in learning it is the stakes at which you learn it. So it's a bit like you draw a chalk line on the floor and walk on the chalk line, big deal. But if that line is a tightrope between two buildings, the game changes completely. So it's not about the width of the line. It's about what will happen if you fall off the line. And I think that element no other career can give you, where you actually carry the burden of command. You carry, at times, the body of your comrade on your shoulder, not physically, but not just literally, but also as a metaphor, because you are responsible. Your decisions will have the potential to create widows, has the potential to create orphans. Now, in that context, when you look at leadership, every lesson is a lesson drawn in blood. So, in terms of just learning how to lead people, learning how to communicate, learning how to create a shared reality, learning to create a vision statement that can get people to jump on a grenade, learning how to motivate and create a larger-than-life mission which will get people, soldiers under your command, to volunteer for a mission from which they know that, in which they know the attrition rate could be as high as 80%, which means that 8 out of 10 people will sort of buy it in that operation and still they volunteer. To my mind, there isn't a better school of leadership to learn that. And that should be the second driver. And I think the Army now gives that opportunity in terms of short service commission, where you can join for 5 to 8 years. And after the 8th year, you can take a call whether you want to leave that and pursue a second career. And as I can personally vouch for, everything that I did, whether it was in the corporate world or in the bureaucracy, a large part of that training happened in the armed forces. So it gives you a rock-solid foundation for the rest of your life. And that should be the second driver. The third driver, interestingly, if you look at the B schools and the education, whether it's in terms of management frameworks and all of that, you realize that the fountainhead of all of this is in the armed forces. And I'm not necessarily saying just the Indian armed forces. If you look at, the grouping of a platoon, that's 40 people, and 40 people across the world. It's not just in India, Pakistan, or Commonwealth countries. It used to be 35 to 40 people, whether it was the Incas, the Mayans, the Mongolians, and the Tatars, who didn't even know of each other's existence. So when you look at a company, for instance, company is what is commanded by usually a captain or a major, and that's about 180 to 200 people, the span of control. And that's roughly the size of a Facebook group. So you suddenly realize that the basic fundamentals of management framework, James McKinsey is a colonel. He basically took the logistics which was used in the war planning and converted it into a company. And so all these companies that swear by McKinsey today are basically listening to an army colonel. And
I should tell you, I'm an alumnus of McKinsey.
Oh, there you go. So there you know. So you've been trained well before you even knew that you were being trained by the heritage of a. So in many ways, as I tell a lot of young people, that if you have to learn these management principles, then why not go to the fountainhead? Why are you learning it secondhand from a B school? Because the origin of all of these principles in many ways is more contenders fighting for less resources is the definition of war. More contenders fighting for less resources is the definition of business. So I think for a young person who is looking to embark on a journey which allows him a multitude of options. I think the fundamentals of learning how to manage people, how to manage frameworks, how to think out of the box, how to communicate under adverse circumstances, how to reach out into your own self and find that extra few ounces of strength that you need to tackle the adversity. There isn't a better sort of institution which can teach that. And I think these should be the three drivers, you know, sort of why people should consider the forces as a very, I would say, top three career option, because it gives you the option of doing that and going out and doing anything else as well.
Sure. No, very well articulated. As a corollary, Raghu, I'm also curious about what the lows are in a career path. You know, sometimes if you go back to the point you made about the first few weeks and months being intense, and deliberately so to weed out the tourists, as you said. But on a more serious note, what are the type of people that join the army for the wrong reason or join the army and very quickly realize that it's not for them? So are there any insights on what questions people should ask themselves to ensure they don't make the wrong choice?
So that's a very good question. And like I said, I believe that one of the strongest filters that exists in the system to make sure that the wrong people don't join, or rather there's no wrong or right, but people who are not suitable for that profession don't join, is the Services Selection Board. And that intensive process, which is you've got a group task officer, you've got a psychologist, and you've got experts who can understand where your heart lies, where your mind lies, and will you crack under pressure. These people, I think, do a very good job of seeing whether you have it in you or not. Mm-hmm. Now, fact of the matter is, I actually encourage a lot of my kids of my friends and all that, and so just give the SSB at least once. Now, whether you decide to join or not is a subsequent step. But the very act of appearing for the selection board gives you a very good insight into yourself, whether you have
experience
it in
itself.
Experience in itself, and you realize whether you have it in you or not. And I must say that, you know, one of the most fascinating things I've found of the Service Selection Board is, and I think a lot of companies can learn, HR especially can learn from that. So they have this 5-day process, and at the end of the 5-day process, they, out of a group of about 50 or 60 people, one or two people get selected. And so after all processes are done, they are reassembled in the hall, and the names that are read out are the names of the people who did not make it. And it is not about that batch. They begin by saying Amitabh Bachchan did not make it in so-and-so in this board in so-and-so year. Or a Kapil Dev, he did not make it. So it's an amazing way to tell the 48 people who have not made it that there is another career waiting for you. And this is not the end of the world. And then finally they talk about the two who have made it. So I think that's in itself is a great lesson, that how do you send back 48 disappointed people, but send them back with a high, with wind under their wings, rather than telling them, you know, because you didn't make it, so you know. So I think starting from that moment, in many ways, the decision gets made for you, whether you have it in you or not. Having said that, obviously the army is not a piece of cake, and when you are learning how to sort of lead people through life and death situations, the training is traumatic. It's not a piece of cake. It draws upon your sort of reserves and your mental toughness, mental robustness. It tests it to the limit. There is obviously separation from family. That's one way to look at it. Another way to look at it is to redefine family. So an Indian Army Jawan, for example, will spend 2 months in a year with his family and 10 months with his unit, and he will do that for 20 years of his life. So I think that's a redefinition of what family is. There is obviously a lot of instability if you look at it one way. I choose to look at it from a point that every 2 to 3 years you get a different exposure. You are in physically a different place. You are in a different portfolio. You are dealing with different kind of challenges, and that brings a kind of a diversity to your thinking, your growth, all of that. So I wouldn't really say that there are any downsides to it. It depends on how you look at it. If you look at every 2 years as being unstable, then yes, it's a downside. Then you're probably meant for a career which you're not going to move down, or you're not going to, you know, have too much of instability over or separation from what you consider to be an essential part of your family, if you define it that way. But if you say every 2 to 3 years you are given a new assignment, a challenging, and usually one up assignment, and that's another thing which happens in the forces is willy-nilly because of shortage of officers, officers are taking are thrust with responsibilities which are more than what the org structure has determined to be. So you do get a lot more exposure at a much younger age, and you start discovering your rate of growth is not determined necessarily by a rule book, but by the opportunities that are thrown your way and how quickly you sort of master those opportunities.
Just picking up on SSB, since you mentioned it, I'm really curious because I believe we are moving from a world, the industrial world, where a lot of the hiring used to happen based on experience, to a VUCA digital world, where a lot of the hiring is happening on potential, intrinsic potential, not so much what the person has done, but what the person can do. So if you had to sort of distill, let's say, without getting into the specifics, the 5 days of the rigorous interview process, and really say, as we look for identifying potential, what are the 3-4 things the corporate world can learn from the SSB process, which can help companies bet on these horses for the long term? What would you say?
That's, I think, a very good question. And I think it's possibly, so you have to understand that in the forces, probably the army in some sense, I won't even say uniformed forces because the police doesn't work that way. But the army, even the chief of the army staff has to join as a lieutenant. There is no question of, you know, doing a PhD and coming in and joining as a brigadier or something like that. It doesn't work that. So sure. The police has the IPS officers who come in laterally and they, you know, sort of join at a fairly senior rank. But in the army, every officer has to join when he's in his, or he or she's, is literally, for most of them, it's their first job. And they have to go through the, and for many of the officers of the Indian Armed Forces, it is their first job in some sense. So, in the game of SSB, in the game of army, there is no way to do anything about his previous experience. It doesn't really matter. Sure. What matters is only the potential. Right, so the 5 days, the aspects that are being looked in there, I think that's, it's better we understand that and then look at how the corporates can leverage it. Of course, there is the general physical fitness. You want a person, but I should tell all the listeners, and especially the kids who are listening, that anybody who thinks that he's not physically fit and therefore should not apply to the army, that's a myth. Because so long as you are, you know, sort of okay in the sense that you have your arms and legs and, you know, you're not dramatically invalidated by some physical...
We're not looking for John Rambo.
But not at all. Matter of fact, physical fitness is the least of the scores as well in the SSB, because these are trainable skills. They are skills. I mean, I used to be a college kid in Delhi who wouldn't run after the bus, saying that the second bus will come. And within 18 months, I was running 16 kilometers in cross-country. And that's something that the army will do. That's not a problem. What they're looking for are untrainable skills, which are more in terms of officer-like qualities, that will you crack under pressure? Do you have the ability to work as a team? Can you get other people to work with you without being threatened by you? You may be a great performer, but if you piss off everyone else in your team, or if everyone else in the team views you as a competition or as a person who likes to hog all the limelight, you may be the, you know, ace stud, but you'll never go beyond an individual contributor. You'll never be able to run a team.
Yeah.
And in the army, it's all about the team. Nobody gives a, you know, jack shit whether you got your stuff or not. It's whether the team won or didn't win. It's as simple as that. It's all people together. It's never, you know, 8 of us got in, but 12 didn't get through. It doesn't make sense. I mean, it's all the 20 have to get in or all. Yeah. It's all or nothing. It's that format. Now, that format requires people to be able to look at the bigger picture. It requires them to think out of the box for problem solving. You must remember that in the army, I think what they teach most people is fundamental problem solving. That is why you are able to take the same troops and send them for flood relief in Chennai, for earthquake in Nepal, for building a Commonwealth bridge in Delhi, for taking children out of a borewell when they are stuck there. I mean, there is no training given for taking children out of a borewell. That doesn't happen in the academy. What happens is you are taught how to solve problems as a group. And I think that's what they're looking at. They're looking at whether people have an open mind, whether they can do that kind of stuff, or are they too fixated? Is their cup too full? Is they too self-centered? Then those are the traits which will probably be a sort of a disadvantage. They also have a very intensive psychological profiling, and they have tests, which I'm sure you can Google and find out about word association or writing a narrative based on a picture that you're shown. And this is more to look at But the interesting thing is that there are three different vectors that happen. So there's a group task, there is an individual psychological assessment, and then there is an interview. And what they also look for is inconsistency between the three. So if anyone, and that's why I recommend to a lot of people that you might want to take some basic guidelines, but don't try and get coached on it because it's a waste of money. They can straight away spot if you have been coached. And oftentimes people who have been coached will start showing inconsistencies between their three or four tests, and that will be actually worse off than being consistently...
You can't game such a system.
You can't game such a system. I mean, these people have, they have done it, they do it for a living for... I mean, they can look into your eyes and figure out what you're thinking. So it's pointless trying to game them. And so that in a nutshell is what one expects in the SSB. And of course, the elements that I spoke about, what can be derived into the corporates as well. And many corporates are doing it now. So you have a lot of these YSC and these kind of tests which happen to look at an cultural and an aptitude fit. Even construction of a team, by the way. So in a team, you don't need everybody who looks like each other in their thinking or whatever. So now, in the forces, they do that. So when they sort of populate a battalion, they will take a look at the OLQ. OLQ is the officer-like quality scores of the previous three officers who have gone there. And they will calibrate the fourth officer in such a way that he complements the previous three rather than becoming a clone of the previous three. So even in organizations, I think in the corporate sector, my sense is a lot of the times when recruitment is being done, you're basically carbon copying one or two individuals and saying, you know, if I can get 10 more of these guys, I'm okay. Oftentimes, JDs are designed that way. You know, a manager who doesn't have time will often pass a CV of existing employee and say, find me three more of these. But I think that's the wrong way to do it. Because unless you really do need three more of the same people, it might be better to get skills which are complementary or perhaps at some levels diametrically opposite.
Look at the portfolio at a team level.
Exactly. So look at the portfolio of leadership qualities rather than saying that I want that, you know, that 9-point leader, I want four of them. That is usually a very bad team. If you get four alphas in one team, that team will start competing within itself.
Raghu, moving on to a different theme. You've transitioned from very different worlds, the armed forces world to the corporate world to the government world, and now back to the corporate world. One of the pieces I'm always curious about is the first 90-100 days of a leader into an organization often can be make or break, right? And one needs to be thoughtful about how you spend the time. And it's a combination of acclimatizing to the new culture, but at the same time, keeping your individuality because you come with a bunch of good practices from a different world. So give us an insight into those phases. If you could just sharpen the lens on those phases and what you've learned in terms of lessons on how you manage transitions.
So, of course, in hindsight, I can put a structure around that learning. And I must confess, though, that when the transition was happening, I consider myself extremely fortunate that I had a few people who happenstance sort of serendipity brought into my life who were able to guide me and help me not make mistakes which I could have made when I was doing that transition. But in hindsight, if I were to look back and say if this process could be done much better, then this is the way I would probably do it today. Okay. To my mind, any organization, regardless of where it exists, whether it's in the private sector, government, or the army, it falls into one of these four categories. It'll either be a startup, or it'll be a turnaround, or it'll be an organization that requires a realignment from where it is, or it is a steady state organization. Now, all these four require very different styles of leadership. In a startup, you require some sense of energy and a shared reality and a chutzpah and say, we need to head in this general direction, but you really don't know what the goal is going to be. I mean, any startup, if it starts trying to figure out plans more than, 12 to 14 months, 12 to 18 months, it's basically going to go wrong because it's more about choosing to do something different, have a general line of direction and go with that. If you're doing a turnaround, for example, then the leader, when he takes over the turnaround, he will, give some arbitrary decisions just to indicate that there is a new sheriff in town. So that's more a strategy of ready, fire, and aim. I mean, you make your presence felt by doing some brisance in the organization. You shatter some things to indicate that there is a new leader. It's going to be new. You can't try that in a steady state organization, because in a steady state organization, you need to spend the first 90 days just learning what makes them tick and not tweaking anything which is just working fine, because you don't know what string you'll pull and which part will unravel completely, because it's a steady state. There is an expectation. Now, none of these jobs are, or none of these situations are more difficult or less difficult. I mean, a startup is equally difficult as a steady state. I mean, imagine stepping into the shoes of Steve Jobs. Steady state organization, expectation from you is that you are going to deliver something dramatically different, right? So, I think the first element that any leader needs to do is to decipher or diagnose what state the organization is in, which one of these four states the organization is in. And I think also what the leader needs to do is to decipher what state is he or she most comfortable in. So if I'm a startup, you know, my affinity is towards startup, and startup leaders are, or turnaround leaders are leaders who will give their commitment and then seek clarity. Steady state leaders are people who would give their commitment only after getting clarity. So they would seek a lot of clarity before they give their commitment. Now, if you try to apply a startup model on a steady state organization, you will obviously go wrong, dramatically wrong, no matter how great a leader you are, because you will try to, you know, buck things. So if I went into, say, let's say the government, and if I tried to do a startup mentality there, unlikely that it'll do well. Yeah. I need to recognize this is a steady state, this is a super tanker. If you want to turn it, you'll have to first get consensus and begin the turn. You can't just stand at the, you know, at the bridge one day and say, okay, we're going to do a hard turn, right? Not going to happen. Yeah. Whereas in a startup or in a turnaround, you will have to take decisions of that kind. So I think rather than the transition from the army to the civil, of course, there are certain nuances there. There's no doubt about it. All said and done, in the Indian Army, we don't run the risk of, you know, 20 of our soldiers quitting and joining the Pakistani Army. That doesn't happen. And that happens all the time in the private sector. So you will have to, you know, sort of factor those kind of nuances. But other than that, I think the base framework is the framework that I just spoke about, that you first diagnose what is the state of the company or the organization or the subunit. And by the way, these cultures can coexist in a same company. Sure. So you can have a massive company, which is a steady state, but two of its units or two sub-companies might be going through a turnaround.
Subcultures.
The subcultures will exist. It's by definition, they will exist in large countries and large companies and larger sort of establishments.
Got it. And since you spoke about Army and the 11 years you spent there, clearly there's a reservoir of leadership in the Army, right? And I realize that the civil world is very different. Do you have any reflections on what some of those leaders could do to ensure that they settle in well? Because I believe that genuinely the corporate world could benefit a lot from some of the leaders who are alumni of the Army. And again, I say this more at an executive level and also at a board level. There are several generals and brigadiers who have a lot of wisdom in terms of what it takes to run an operation, what it takes to run a good strategy, and so on. So any thoughts on how to bridge the two worlds in terms of ensuring that the corporate world could benefit from
that? So that again, Deepak, is an amazing question. And I think I've always been quite passionate about this area, not because I'm ex-army and therefore I would like to, you know, sort of advocate the case of forces officers coming in. But if you study countries like the US or for that matter even Europe, you realize that a large part of their spurted growth happened immediately after the Vietnam War or after the Second World War. And of course, there was a lot of nation rebuilding and all happening. But what a lot of social commentators or historians, contemporary historians, have not paid enough attention to is the fact that immediately after the Vietnam War, for the next 15 to 20 years, every able-bodied man in the US had served in the forces, and there was a common vocabulary. They were coursemates and comrades, and you know, one could just pick up the phone and reach out to someone else in another organization and get that extra leg up because of another relationship which was there. The ex-forces people are doing exceedingly well in the U.S., as you're aware, probably, that, Howard ran a cover story on how servicemen who are coming back from Afghanistan and Iraq are being snapped up by the corporates because they bring a completely different kind of leadership skill. So the potential is clearly there. Now, honestly, I think in India, that potential has not been leveraged. So cases of people who have come from the armed forces and had a commensurately successful career in the private sector aren't that many.
Yeah.
Now, there's some fundamental reasons for that. One of the reasons is that in India, unlike in the US, we've had a very wide chasm between the forces and the civilian counterparts. At times, it's almost a disdain. You know, there's a sense of disdain for the civilians or the army guys, and there's a huge lack of knowledge. I mean, you probably are
probably
a hybrid because you have, you know, education thrust into you.
No, but 15 years back,
thought about the army was completely, and I'm sure it would have been the same for a lot of civilians, a lot of army people when they think about civilian, or for that matter, the bureaucracy. I mean, we all have these stereotypes about, you know, army mein ration free and bureaucrats don't work, and these are, you know, wrong stereotypes.
Broad brushes,
they're not even true. Even if they were broad, I mean, I would say even if they were like 30% right, one could say it's a broad brushstroke, but they are completely false. These are factually incorrect in many ways. So I think one of the challenges or one of the areas where forces officers would probably is to three things. One is for them to realize that they are going back to a second career and they are going to restart as a, in at least in some areas, as a lieutenant all over again. So it doesn't matter where they retired from. If they think that I am a brigadier or I'm a general in my head and I come with that element into a completely new domain. I mean, it's a bit like saying I'm very fluent in French and so I should be treated with respect in Egypt. You're not going to be. You'll have to learn Arabic there. You'll have to learn you'll have to learn the lingo and you'll have to start all over again. And if you have to learn, you have to bend. That's the only way to learn. You have to be. You have to have the humility to say, "Ki, I don't know this and I need to be taught this." So that transitioning into a civilian career is, I think, the first step where the forces need to be educated on the transition. The second is, I think, people need to choose the kind of portfolio that they would like to sort of. To my mind, when people come from the forces into the private sector, there are five major categories in which they can come. The first and the most obvious choice is security, and to my mind that's a very under-leveraging of the potential. Yeah. The second is an adjunct to that, which is more in terms of administration. The third is HR, because you have been leading troops and all of that. The fourth is operations, because that's the large part of the forces. But the fifth and the holy grail is the P&L. You run a profit and loss sort of. There's a score that is being kept literally on a quarterly basis on how well you're doing. And I think that is the holy grail. But to get to that holy grail, I think there needs to be a grounding, a re-education, understanding many elements of. So, for example, cost and finance is something that most of the forces are completely, sort of insulated from. I mean, because we really don't care how much a tank that we operate costs. And, it's not done on a sort of P&L basis. You don't hire people based on P&L. If you're authorized 800 people, you fight to get those 800 people.
It's a different commercial context.
It's a very different context. So at an operational level, there's no commercial context to it. And I think that's extremely important in the private sector. So unless those elements are learnt, there would be dissonance. So I don't think any army officer should think that they will be able to automatically morph the learnings that they have got from another world into this world. And similarly, I don't think any civilian leader should believe or have a false expectation that just because he's brought somebody from another domain, they will hit the ground running. That's not going to happen. So there will be some mistakes that they'll make in the beginning. There will be some sort of acclimatization, as you rightly said. And part of acclimatization is actually making some mistakes. So if both sides expect a zero error syndrome to work from day one, then it's a wrong expectation. And I think that part is something that I think at the Jamaans level, we do it pretty well in terms of reskilling. Not as much as we should, but we definitely have these reskilling programs and all. In officers, now they have started a kind of a mini MBA in some of these B schools, but to my mind, that's really not enough, because the mini MBA only teaches you theoretical knowledge. It doesn't teach you the mechanics of how things work, the unarticulated power structures, for example, in organizations, or navigating the politics of organizations. And politics, to my mind, is not a bad word, because politics is the art of polity. So it's not necessarily a dirty word just because It has been dirtied by some people, but it's not the science of politics is not bad. So I think learning that, learning how to lead without influence, without authority, by learning only by leading only by your influence. Now these are some of the things which I think military leaders also need to make a transition in. They have to realize that in this new career, they are literally drinking through a hose. So that's the kind of learning that they have to...
And any lessons from the other markets? You mentioned US and some of the other countries. So any lessons on how they bridge this cultural gap? One is the cognitive gap, which a bridge course can bridge.
So actually, one of the areas where I believe India is at a disadvantage is that formally in many of the Western countries, there is education about the defense forces. So you, if you were graduating from, say, the US, would know far more about military in general. You'd know about the D-Day landings. You'd know about what the Vietnam War. You would have been brought up on a diet of not just war movies, but historical movies. There would be like hundreds of books written on the Vietnam War and what happened in World War One, World War Two.
What are the American conscience? Basically.
It's part of the civil society's consciousness, and I have a theory for that, and I believe that's because all those countries have faced an existential threat. So whether in hindsight you say that, you know, Japan could have never threatened the US, but after the Pearl Harbor raid, even as deep in Chicago, people were diving into air raid shelters because that was the fear, the existential fear that the Soviet Union would take you out. And that is why the entire country as a whole needed to be made aware about defense. Now, India, fortunately or unfortunately, has never had an existential crisis. So even when you are raging a full-blown war with Pakistan in 1971, large parts of South India are completely unaffected. Even you have something happening in Sri Lanka, in IPKF, large parts of North India don't even know what's going on there. So I don't think as a nation we have ever got together to realize that we can have an existential crisis. And that, to my mind, has created this whole sort of an insulation of the forces from the rest of the world, the rest of the country. Not even us versus them, but... Cantonment word comes from containing troops in another location, and they are in their own la-la land, and the contained troops also think that they are in their own bubble. And I think this osmosis advantage we have not had, which has happened in the US. The second is, I think, again, a derivative of the first point, where many of the leaders in the US or in UK or in Europe until about 10 to 15 years ago, were from a generation who actually fought wars themselves. I mean, they've been involved in the Second World War, they've been involved in Vietnam War, or they've seen the Korean War and all of that stuff. And they have a very high representation of forces in their political establishment, in business establishment, in industry. Unfortunately, that's not the case in India. Most of our ex-servicemen who do come out, they are either sort of relegated to security duties and they will only handle security, or there'll be that one odd token general in some board. But the general will still be leveraged only for his security, you know, sort of expertise, or maybe man management expertise at some level, or a little bit of operations, but never in terms of strategy and stuff like that. So I think that osmosis has not taken place, and it's not something that we can start tomorrow. It'll take a generation of officers to come out, to earn their spurs, to earn the respect in the CV street, to speak the same lingo, and demonstrate to their civilian counterparts that they are equally good leaders in a P&L environment. They understand profit, they understand loss, they understand money. As you probably realize, there is almost an unspoken culture in the army not to be concerned about money. I mean, it's almost a disdained aspect. Talking about money is considered to be... Now, that's important in the army because obviously you're not being driven by material incentives there. But that's what keeps the score in the civilian street. So you can't say that I'll play by the same rules here.
So it's a rewiring that needs to
happen. It's a rewiring. It's a complete rewiring. And I think more importantly, it is a understanding that there needs to be a rewiring. It's not just the rewiring itself, but a consciousness on part of that leader who's transitioning from one place to another.
It's an awareness issue number one.
That I need to be rewired. And that's true for any transition. It's not just from one sphere to another. It's any transition, even life transitions.
Raghu, moving on to a different theme, I'm curious to discuss some of the elements of leadership that we can learn from the armed forces. I've heard you talk about the scale-up technology that the corporate world, specifically the startup world, can learn from. I'd love for you to elaborate on that.
Well, actually, like I've mentioned in a couple of my other talks, if you look at the technological development that has happened during the times of conflict, I mean, try and visualize that before the Second World War began, the world was in propeller planes. And by the time it ended, more than six countries had their own fighter jets developed, productionized, and industrialized to a number that they could actually be fielded in the Second World War. And that doesn't just mean producing the aircraft. It means the whole ecosystem of the MRO and pilots and strategy and logistics and all of that. Every piece of technology you use today, 90% of it comes from conflict. So whether it's radio, sonar, radar, internet, was developed largely to prevent a nuclear, in case of a nuclear fallout, you didn't want to rely on a system which was point-to-point failure system. That's why a gridded system was the DARPA basically created that. Now, there is some logic in that when humankind is fighting for existential reasons, they are likely to put their best minds, whether it's the harnessing of the nuclear energy itself or many of the, technological marvels that we today take for granted. Their origin is in origin of conflict. Similarly, if you look at nations like Israel, which is known as the startup nation, one of the contributing factors is the fact that young kids, they are given exposure to technology which in the civilian street they will never get. So that 2 years conscription or 3 years conscription in case of men gives them an exposure to bleeding-edge technology, very, very expensive technology, which they would not otherwise get an exposure to in normal other careers.
Right.
So there is a whole element of technology that is used in the forces, and it's a great sort of a platform from where you can begin thinking about how some of the elements of innovation which leads, whether it's innovation of technology, innovation of processes, innovation of thinking out of the box, it provides a very strong foundation there.
Right.
Now, the example that you're referring to is more an example of how you may create a framework which, see, one of the challenges actually in an organization which is trying to scale up is that when you look at a small team, when it starts up, it's typically about 3 to 4 people, founders who get some administrative help, logistic help, sales help, and a typical startup is 10 men.
Yeah.
10, when I say 10 men, 10 people. And that's a section in the armed forces. Usually, the second stage will be anywhere between 35 to 40 people.
Right.
So that second stage is roughly the size of a platoon. And then when you move from there to your next sort of tranche, it will usually be about 150 to 200 people, which is the size of a company. So company as in company in the army.
Yeah.
It's also called a company or a squadron in case of the armored corps. Now, the fundamental spans of control and expansion limits and boundaries are already sort of defined. They go back a few 100,000 years. It's not something that is happening new. It's not a span of control is not something that is something new. That's been happening since many, many hundred years ago. So rather than reinventing the wheel, one could look at these models and modify it wherever required and be able to implement it in today's world as well. That's what I meant by saying that there are certain frameworks and certain vocabularies that if you just transition from or morph from another world and bring into this world, you straight away can hit the ground running rather than trying to recreate it from scratch. One of the models that I strongly advocate is for any organization and a team of people to have what is called a common vocabulary.
Right.
And by common vocabulary, I don't mean that organizations have to become clones of each other. Just like there are certain protocols in say, the IT system, and that's why an MS Word document is able to talk to an Excel sheet, which is able to talk to a PowerPoint presentation, because those protocols allow these different programs to talk to each other seamlessly.
Right.
Similarly, I think organizations need to have their individual characteristics, they need to have their idiosyncrasies, their own cultures. But at an operating level, they need to have a common lingo. Without that, so suppose I say, give that document to me ASAP. As soon as possible. Now, as soon as possible for me may be 45 minutes. For you, it could be 3 days. If I tell you, take a look at this document. For you, it could be the font is okay. There's a lot of white space. The grammar is right. For me, it could be run it past the regulator, run it past the compliance guide, run it past the legal guys. That's what I mean when I say,
sure,
take a look at that document, because that's what I would do. Now, if we don't have a common vocabulary within an operating system, then there is a lot of things will fall through the cracks. A lot of people will get frustrated. There'll be a lot of, you hear these sentences very often in the corporate, he just doesn't get it. The moment you hear the sentence, he just doesn't get it. This is two different vocabularies clashing with each other. Now, one of the things that the that I think the forces focus a lot on is while they will allow the regiments to have their own cultures and their own characters and there is their own idiosyncrasies, the way they will greet each other, the festivities that they will celebrate and all of that stuff. But when it comes to operations, when someone says half right turn, there is no debate in anyone's mind that it is 45 degrees. It's not 43, 47, it is 45 degrees. Now that framework, if organizations start absorbing at their initial stage, when they're in the startup mode, then scaling becomes much easier because you are, you know, proliferating the same. So it's like having an alphabet set. So you say, I'm going to use A to Z as my alphabet set. But typically what happens in organizations, they use A to Z during their initial stage. Then they decide to change the vocabulary when they're going to the next stage. Now when they subsume another company inorganically, then again the vocabulary changes. So this dissonance which it causes within the organization, it's a bit like five horses pulling a chariot and each horse is just off by 5 degrees. So there's a lot of pulling and, you know, dragging happening and each horse believes that the other four are not pulling their weight. But the chariot isn't moving forward. And I think that's what I mean by having a common vocabulary and frameworks which can which act as the skeletal, you know, sort of the skeleton of the organization on which muscle can be added and flesh can be added, but the skeleton sort of holds the entire shape together.
Got it. And I'm particularly curious about the acronym ZKITBAG you'd used in one of the presentations.
Yeah, it's okay.
And I felt when I listened to it, I felt it was, you know, back in McKinsey, we used to use the term MISI,
yeah,
mutually exclusive and collectively exhaustive. So it felt like a holistic framework. So if you could expand on that for a couple of minutes.
Sure. And like I must say, the MISI framework, this is a framework that is, it's got a great, you know, sort of flexibility in that it can be used by a section commander of 10 men, and he does use it, right up to an army commander who commands millions. So the framework also makes sure that every aspect of your briefing is covered in a subheading. It also makes sure that your subordinates or your peers who are listening to your briefing or even in your own thinking, they know exactly at what point they have to sort of pay attention. Because if I'm a logistics person, I know that after this is my turn and after this has been covered, it'll come. So the ZKITBAG is an acronym that we use very often in the army to teach people how to think, how to give orders, how to plan, how to build strategy. And I mean, like most things in the army or most things that really, really work well, the fundamental structure is very simple. And it has to be because it has to be taught to a 12th class pass jawan. He has to understand it. So how do you create a framework within an organization where the last trooper on ground is aware of the strategic intent of his overall commander? How may he assume orders in the absence of orders?
Which is equivalent to the sales guy on the street knowing what the CEO is thinking, right?
Not just what the CEO is thinking, but if my CEO is not here and I need a direction, what would my CEO give me as a direction? What would he? So how to assume orders in the absence of orders? That is the fundamental reason for a framework like this. So it's a very simple framework and its origin lies in the orders and the briefing of the Indian Armed Forces. And as you probably are aware, the Indian Armed Forces heritage is largely from the erstwhile British Indian Army. So the use of the lingo is peppered with Urdu and erstwhile Hindustani. So it's not, and of course some elements of English because the orders were, you know, sort of British officers and Hindi-speaking, Urdu-speaking troops.
Sure.
So Z, of course, stands for Zamini Nishan. A loose translation of that in the civilian street would be environmental scan. So before you're beginning an operation, you've got to give the troops an orientation. You're fighting in a desert. What does that mean? How does it, you know, when the daytime temperatures goes up to this much, nighttime it plummets to this much. These are the sort of canals which describe our boundaries. So if you cross this canal, it means basically you've gone past your target. You know, so you are orienting them to the environmental scan, and that has an application in the civil street as well. If you say you're trying to decide a strategy for, say, the pharma sector, then your environmental scan will talk about what are the regulations in that space, who are the regulators, what are the boundary conditions,
what are the patent laws.
Yep. You need to understand all of that kind of stuff. The kit bag as an acronym is also chosen so the soldiers remember. Kit bag is simple to remember. You'll never forget kit bag. And Z, of course, if you just prefix it, you'll remember Z kit bag. K stands for khabar. Khabar is information. So, and information is always, it starts with your competitor's information first. So you'll always brief your team on the org structure of the enemy commanders, what is their, what are their strong points, what are their weak points, which areas are the ones, which are their hot buttons. So you could mess with some of your, say, competitors in all over India. But if you mess with them in their hometown, the response will be disproportionately hard. So understanding your competitor's khabar, information, and then it's followed by your own khabar. Who are you? What is your strength? What are your sister organizations? What are the boundary conditions between the sister organizations? So the two of the sister organizations are not pitching for the same account. So you understand whom can you call for support in case you require assistance in, you know, say, digital some stuff, then there is an arm of ours which can provide us with that support. So it's khabar apni. I stands for irada. What is the strategic intent? What are you trying to achieve out of this entire exercise? So it's not just the transactional steps. It is what is the overall intent of the commander? How that intent is sort of checked back. So you actually give out an irada and then you check back with your troops that repeat the strategic intent. So that verbatim they are able to repeat that. It becomes ingrained in every person as a North Star. That this is the strategic intent of my commander. Not the interim steps. Those are only ways to achieve the strategic intent. T in kit bag, T stands for tariqa. Tariqa is methodology. How are you going to achieve this strategic intent? What are the various phases in which you will do that? How will you hand over from one phase to the next phase? Who will be the phase two commander? What will be the sign that phase one has ended and phase two has begun? What will be the milestones and how will you communicate with various different teams? If there is overlap, who will be responsible for the overlap? And the tariqa goes into those details. Bandobast is resourcing, troops to task, as we call it. Yeah. That to achieve this objective, how many troops to task do you need? Do you have sufficient troops? Is there a backup? If the first piece does not work, do you have enough resilience in, say, your cash flow to take care of, say, 6 months of your sales plan not, you know, actually fructifying?
Resources.
It's troop, like what we call troops to task, which means for this task, how much of troops do you need? What are the resources? Yeah, so resourcing. Mm-hmm. A stands for administration. So, I mean, again, many companies fail because they don't look at that part. They do the hiring, but they haven't got the laptop piece in place. So they don't have the seating because that's in a dissonance. So you suddenly have 40 employees you have given appointment letters to, but you have seating space for only 13. Yeah. And so 22 of them are supposedly working from home or not working at all or are drawing pay and, you know, waiting for... So administration basically talks about all the administrative requirements which need to be done. And G stands for, I think, one of the most important aspects which is ignored, unfortunately, several times in organizations, and that is ghadi milao. And what that implies is, if I am a infantry commander who's going to launch an attack at my target, and let's say I'm going to launch the attack at first light, which is at 6 o'clock in the morning, and before I launch my attack, I want that complete area to be softened, as we say, by artillery fire. And I want the firing to start from 5:50 to 6 o'clock. 10 minutes, I want intense firing on the target. And as soon as the firing lifts, when the troops there are badly, you know, sort of damaged or dazed, then I launch the attack. Now, you can imagine what could go wrong if my watch and my artillery commander's watch is just off by 1 minute. That 1 minute, I will launch the attack and they will be firing, still firing. So it's extremely important to synchronize our timelines. Timelining, I think, is an extremely important but often ignored, especially when you're looking at large enterprises which have many moving parts. So once again, Z, Zameeni Nishan, K, Khabar, I, Irada, T, Tarika, B, Bandobast, A, Administration, G, Ghadi Milao. Now, if you just remember this acronym in the back of your head, then whether it's a talk that you're going to do, whether it's a strategy paper you're going to write, whether it's just collecting your thoughts together, whether you want to do an exercise of this nature that you're doing, you would have a fair point-by-point you know, sort of thinking in your head. More importantly, your team will know. So your admin guy will know that my turn will start after Bandobast is over. After B is over, my turn will start. And I therefore need to pay attention from this point onwards. Right. Or I need to factor in for these troops to task. So it's a very ordered mechanism. And this framework can be used, as I mentioned, from a section of 10 men right up to an army of 500,000 men.
And specifically on the intent part, I was curious because you mentioned the man on the street needs to know the intent of the CEO. Again, any thoughts on just how do you ensure that the chain of communication, both two-way, right? Again, the CEO has viewership or has visibility to what the salesman is thinking and vice versa. Any lessons to be learned on how that chain can be efficient?
Again, a lot of lessons, and they're not necessarily just in the component of Zkit back. But if you see the fundamentals of leadership in combat, they have certain fundamentals for a leader. And one of the fundamentals is that leaders should be upfront. The reason why leaders should be upfront is basically because then they can spot those fleeting opportunities in the fog of war. They can actually see the chain of that information coming to him is not a distorted and a long chain. Right. It is instantaneous on the spot. That is why you have what is called field commanders. So when you say major and above is a field commander, which means in field, he can take certain decisions, whether they are promotions, demotion, changing of command, handing over charge. You think someone is damn good in logistics, but he's slotted in the wrong place. On the spot, you can make that change and, you know, sort of give your direction. It doesn't have to go through a committee and a board and all of that stuff.
Right.
Now, that is a trait which I think we need to encourage a lot more in corporates. Where, and some companies do it. They have, you know, line of control or 2 days. Like Tesco, for instance, sends some of its most senior management into the tellers. You know, they stand behind the shopping, behind the, and do the teller's job.
Correct.
And they get some great insights and ideas into how to improve their performance. So the second is the entire enterprise must always physically know the leader's location. Mm-hmm. Now, that's again very important because when we are trying to create an organization, you're essentially creating a shared reality.
Right.
And the shared reality has to pivot around either a thought or a leader. Now, if it has to pivot around that leader, then the leader's location is important because otherwise you don't know where the center of gravity is. So the physical location of a leader at any given point of time must be known by the subordinates. Similarly, the leader must have his advisors always physically close to him. So if I have to take a decision and I need to know whether I will have the sufficient artillery support for that or I have the sufficient logistic support for that, for me to be able to take that decision, I cannot say, okay, now this advisor will give me this advice after 2 days. Then that decision cannot be made. Yeah. So these are some of the basic principles using which the forces make sure that the commanders have a very good understanding of what is happening on ground. Also, there is, for example, there are certain portfolios. For instance, in the armored corps and especially in mechanized warfare, there are certain officers who are called recce platoon commanders. Now, recce platoon commander is somebody who is responsible for going out into the no man's land or the areas where you're going to advance and actually carry out a reconnaissance. Now, he may be a junior most officer, but when he comes back and gives his report, that report is listened to by the senior most of army commanders because he knows that it's not about the seniority of this individual, it's about the fact that he has the feel of the ground.
The market scan. Or
he is the man from the streets. Yeah. Now, again, many times, sometimes I see in corporates, people are dismissive of ground reality. And they are dismissive. Why? Because they are senior. So they presume that I do a very, you know, sort of popular exercise now. Sometimes I ask questions in B schools. So for instance, one of my favorite questions in B schools is that I ask these students that tell me, why is it that the cheaper models of phones in India have dual SIM? You would assume that intuitively it should be the more expensive models which would have multiple slots. Right. And the cheaper the model, why would a poor man who is struggling to pay one bill need two slots, mm-hmm. right? And I have found that people in the class, the students in the class, they proceed on two vectors on this. One vector is that they think about the various possibilities and they postulate those possibilities and they discuss it amongst themselves. And I give them sufficient time. I say, okay, you know, I'm asking this question and you can answer it after lunch. The second school of thought, which I find very, very rare, extremely rare, is a kid actually going and asking a security guard or somebody or the sweeper, why do you have two SIM cards? And get the answer straight from the ground, right? Very few do that. Most of them want to do the five forces and you know, Peter Drucker, because they've learned that. They've got the hammer with them. So they want to treat every problem with a Michael Porter's five forces. Whereas the simplest way to get the answer would be to actually ask a poor person, of which there
are,
who is affording a phone of $2,000, that why do you have two SIM cards? And he'll give you the answer. He'll say that one of the SIM is for the incoming call, which is free, and that's a number I can't change because you will call me for chai every day. I can't change that number. The other SIM is for outgoing calls, because that I'll keep doing schemes. If Jio is giving free now, I'll use Jio. If Airtel gives a discount, I'll use Airtel. So for outgoing calls, I will use... And that's the reason why they have two SIMs. So rather than trying to figure it out, you can figure it out, but easier way is to actually go and ask the soldier on ground that why are you doing it this way? And you probably have a much more accurate the accurate answer of why it's being done. So I think that framework is what allows this seamless communication between the front line and of course, by all of this narration, I don't mean that the army does it perfectly and there isn't there's room to improve everywhere. But that's the underlying framework which allows it to happen.
Got it. The other piece, Raghu, again, I've always been curious about is about building culture. Again, there's a lot of talk in the corporate world. And I'm fascinated about the armed forces, because you don't have... As you rightly said, you don't have incentives, right? All you have is culture to carry people with you. So again, what are the two or three things that we could learn in terms of how do you build a culture and how do you build followership?
So firstly, I think I'll correct you there. It's not that the army doesn't have incentive. They're not material incentives. They're different incentives. It's very interesting that there are certain units, for example, the special forces, or let's take NSG, for example, National Security Guard, which is a purely deputationist force, which means that Rashtriya Rifle, another great example, where soldiers will come only for 2 to 3 years. So you will join that outfit for 2 to 3 years, which means at any given point of time, even the commanding officer of that unit will not know more than about 50 to 60% of his people, because he is himself getting rotated, his troops are getting rotated.
Right.
Despite that, organizations have a very strong sense of cultural identity.
Right.
And I think how the forces do it is by storytelling, by creating a narrative of that organization, which is so strong and so powerful that any time a person puts on that uniform and he has got the shoulder badge of whatever it may be, Jat Regiment, Rajput, Bihar, Rashtriya Rifle, 22 MEC, the moment you adopt that, you sort of put on that, clothing on yourself and you become part of that unit, you also are immersed into the legends of that unit. So, for example, one of the rituals that happens in a battalion is, as soon as new soldiers are commissioned in, and they may come in a batch of, say, 15 to 20 or 30 or whatever, they are actually taken around the officer's mess and the quarter guard, and they're shown all the trophies. And every narrative is, so to retrieve this flag, we lost 30 people in that battle. To recover the dead body of one of our comrades, we launched 7 attacks and we lost several more in the process, but we did not let a body of one of our soldiers behind.
Right.
Now, by the time you listen to the third or the fourth or the fifth story, your hair is standing on its end and you realize that you are in a temple. This is not you are in the presence of your ancestors who have left this legacy behind, and that's the expectation from you. I think that's a very important part of corporate, where we have become very antiseptic. We have become very clinical, and these numbers and these sheets and these trend lines, they cannot capture the story of an entrepreneur or two brothers who decide that they're going to make a Jeep in India and suddenly take on the British and create an empire which today is known as the Mahindra and Mahindra Group. Or a man who decides that he wants to build a hotel because whatever reasons. And so the legends of organizations are not, spoken. The art of storytelling is culture building.
Right.
How do you build a culture? How do you know that you are supposed to be You are supposed to have reverence for your elders. It's because somebody has told those stories in your ears, if not necessarily directly, but indirectly, in terms of the shape of stories, in the shape of what happened earlier before you. And I think that is a very, very essential part when you want to forge an organization together. Shared reality is nothing but storytelling. That is what makes us believe that we are right, our country is better, my company is better, my community is better, or I can do this because my ancestors have done it, and I can achieve it because in the past I have done it. These are all elements of storytelling, and that is the fundamental, I think, cementing block to get a group of people together. And that is basically what the armed forces do. They build those legends, those stories. And that's what takes people literally to the next level.
There's a lot that's been written about grit, right? And the role of grit in leaders. And again, if I were to take a specific example, I was reading up on the 2611 operation, and I was told the people that fought it went without food or water for 72 hours, but still, you know, had to do the job. So how do you, and you also alluded to it in earlier parts where you tap into your inner reservoir. Are there any lessons to be learned on how people can build that muscle for them to be able to access that reservoir that a lot of us are blessed with?
So, of course, some of us are blessed with the reservoir, but I think all of us are blessed with the DNA of creating a reservoir.
Right.
Actually, there is a book called Grit. I don't know if you've had an occasion to read it. And the author there specifically mentions how people who are encouraged to fail often make much better leaders. Whereas people who have never ever failed in their life, because life will hand you failures. I mean, there is no planning you can do to even say for your child, for whom you want the absolute everything and you want to cocoon the child from every bad thing in life. There's no way you can do that because failure will happen. Now, anybody who's not dealt with failure in the past will usually collapse catastrophically whenever there is a failure and will not know how to deal with that. I think grit, to my mind, it consists of three or four things. One, it consists of constantly pushing your envelope to say, like, if you ask a civilian or a person who is not a sports-oriented person or someone who is not involved in physical activities, that why don't you run the Mumbai half marathon? They say, are you kidding me? It's 21 kilometers. But I can give you umpteen examples, and I'm sure you know of several people who just decided that this year I'm going to run the half marathon and ended up running the half marathon in a pretty decent time. So the physical capability to do that was always there. It was just the mental lid that the person had. No, 21, of course, how can I run 21? I've never even walked 5 kilometers, so I can't run. So these are self-imposed limitations that all individuals have.
I can relate to the metaphor because 4 years back, I tore a ligament and I had a knee surgery. Mm-hmm. And a couple of years later, I decided to run. And you're right. I would have put myself in that bucket when I had the surgery, but somebody asked me to join a running group and one thing led to another and I realized that it was practice beyond a point.
So it's basically, I remember one of our instructors used to say that if you stop, your body is one. If you fall down exhausted, your mind is one. Because if your body is asking to stop and your mind says, okay, let's stop, then essentially the spirit is willing but the flesh is weak. Whereas if you are able to keep, so when you say grit, it is that this is the pain that I can take, I can't take any more pain. And then you step one more and you say one more element of pain, one more notch up I can take. That's one element of grit. The other element of grit is actually failing.
Right.
And what I mean by failing is, I think failing is not about an exam or it's not about a promotion, it's not about trying an idea and that not working. Failing is us setting as individuals or as organizations a set of conditions, boundary conditions, that we say if we cross this, we have won. I like the metaphor of the high jump in competitions. So when you do the high jump, the way it works is like five people are competing and then you raise the bar and then the three left and then you raise the bar again. And now there are two left and one of them attempts it and the second guy attempts it and he's not able to clear it. It doesn't make the first person automatically a gold medalist. You raise the bar once again.
Right.
Now, despite the fact that there's only one person and he's cleared the previous bar, the bar is raised again. And let's say he clears it again. Once again, the bar is raised. Though for all practical purposes, he's the gold medal winner already. So he can easily take that gold medal and go home and say, I won. But he's now competing with himself, like you compete with yourself in a marathon. You're not competing with, you can't compete with, 5,000 people who are running. 3,000 of them will beat you. So the point is you're competing against yourself, against your previous timing. If it's not the timing, it is against your age or it's against whatever else. I mean, it's a relative target that you have set. And I think it's very important for people. I know this is almost a cliche to say that it's important for people to fail. And organizations also tom-tom about it, that we want to encourage failure. It's how you deal with the first failure that tells the rank and file whether you really mean it or it's a nice sentence to speak in board meetings and stuff like that. Because if the first failure that happens and you come down like a ton of bricks, which is what in most cases happens, then you really are not looking for developing grit in the organization. Then you're looking for a zero error syndrome. And zero error syndrome by definition means there will be no risk, there will be no pushing of the envelope, and there will be no treading away from the beaten path. Because only that guarantees you a higher propensity of zero error. The going off the beaten path, thinking out of the box, pushing the envelope, taking a punt on hiring somebody with a gut feel, even though the paper says that it doesn't seem to make a fit, but your heart tells you, you will fail. If you don't fail, then it's not a punt.
Got it. It's interesting you mentioned this because, if I may, Google recently did a study called Project Aristotle, where they said, let's get to the bottom of what differentiates great teams from good teams, and let's look at data. Let's cut out the faff. And long story short, they boiled down to one variable that they called psychological safety, which in a way alludes to the point you make, which is about having tolerance for error and letting people take risk and fail and for people to feel comfortable in that culture, right? If you sort of don't have that psychological safety in that culture, then you won't take risk, and that by definition comes in the way of outcomes. So it's interesting you mention it. I want to move to a different theme, Raghu, which is about staying present. Again, mindfulness in the digitally distracted world we live in, again, is, I think, a competitive advantage, the way I see it. And again, I go back to 2611 and something I heard you talk about. Specifically, again, if I build on the previous example, 72 hours without food, without water, and then you need to open hundreds of rooms. Right? In each room, you have three situations. You have a civilian or a terrorist or a combination of the two. And what you do has to be different depending on what you find. But you still need to keep your concentration one after another after another. What are the lessons to be learned to cultivate mindfulness, to operate with thought, even under the most extreme of situations? What are the lessons the corporate world can learn?
So definitely this 72 hours without food or water is something that happens because of training. And all special forces, in any commando training, you are deprived of sleep, you are deprived of food, you're fatigued. And matter of fact, in commando training, we are kept under huge stress. And that starts from day one. One of the easiest ways of stress is they never tell you what your next class is. So you have no idea that after I finish this, should I eat a hell of a lot or not at all? Because the next one could be unarmed combat, which means you will vomit out everything that you have eaten. Or it could be another 12-hour trek, which means if you didn't eat, you're screwed. So that uncertainty is kept at every... So you probably one night you would end up at 2 o'clock and your instructors would wake you up at 4 o'clock. So you'd get 2 hours of sleep. Or they would wake you up at 2 or 5 in 5 minutes. So you have no idea when I lay down to sleep whether I'm going to get 5 minutes of sleep, 2 hours of sleep, or no sleep at all. So it is part of training. There's no doubt about it. There is an element of training there. But like many other trainings, including your marathon training, as you're probably aware that when you're training for a half marathon, you actually never run 21 during your training. You never run. The maximum you'll run is 18. Because the last day when you run for the main marathon is when you get into the zone, and that zone takes you. So if you're asking me 26-11, how did those troops perform for 72 hours, part training, part being in the zone? Obviously, zone is an element of muscle memory. So the more you train, we have a saying in the army, which is very, very popular, that the more you sweat in peace, the less you'll bleed in war. So the more amount of time you spend in trying to train for mindfulness. So, for example, I know a lot of my friends who either run or who cycle, and they choose to run or cycle because it's a solitude sport for them. Right. It's not a group sport. They're not. They're while they're running, they are thinking, and when they are thinking, the body is sort of, it goes into that mechanical zone, and one leg after another leg, and they don't realize that they have covered, like, you know, 20 kilometers or 15 kilometers. It's not. So your ability to disassociate from trauma, physical trauma, and almost have your mind operating as if it's in another body. It's not getting these signals that your feet are hurting, your back is hurting, and all because you're. And that's what our ancestors spoke about when they talked about meditation, being able to disassociate from pain or pleasure or whatever. So this is nothing new. This is our, you know, ancient philosophy and all of that coming back together. But I think if you were to say in a corporate world, how I think the corporates, to my mind, need some of the I don't really know how to call it, softer side or a different side, but they do need a different side of training now. I think our training has been so domain knowledge, so framework driven. You hear senior people talk about how they are black belts, Six Sigma, they're you know, quality black belts.
It's about technical skills, right?
It's technical, it's domain, it's acquiring three-letter acronyms behind your name, whether it's certifications or whatever. But the softer side, negotiation skills, persuasion skills, storytelling skills, leading without authority, the ability to, you know, sort of become creative, to say that, okay, fine, I need an answer to this problem. I'm going to, you know, sort of take up my car, take up my bike, go off somewhere, and in 3 days' time, I'll come back. And I'll come back with the answer to these major questions. I don't think those aspects are being looked into. And I think somewhere we got seduced with this absolute falsehood of multitasking and digital assistance and all of that. But I don't think that's true. So if you go back to your sort of childhood, or at least mine, I remember, you know, in the TV, there used to be, well, three programs worth watching. One was a feature film in Hindi. One was one of those English programs, you know, Secrets of the Sea or Here is Lucy or something like that. And then there used to be this Chitrahar thingy. Right. And the Chitrahar would have maybe about six songs, and you would, you know, sort of look at the watch, look at the song, and say, maybe there's one more song. I could maybe, you know, just squeeze one more song that would come out of it.
And there used to be Chitramala original songs, yeah, where you would wait for your song.
Yeah. And now you fast forward to an era where there are like hundreds of channels. And what do you do but? Today when you go to TV, just listen to what I'm saying and map it with your behavior. You flip through channels until you stop at a movie that you have already seen. And you watch a little bit of that movie and then you move on. So you don't even invest in watching a new movie. You want to see glimpses of a movie that you've already seen. Now, this whole notion of multitasking, as people, you know, sort of, it's almost, and I see a lot of alpha leaders almost becoming, you know, macho about it, that I'm able to do seven tasks. And I think a lot of our leaders in the corporate world don't take out the time to just think. Just to introspect, they need their diary filled with activity to make themselves feel productive at the end of the day. So if someone says that I work for 14 hours a day and I had like 23 meetings, he or she believes that day was a very productive day. May have been from a mechanical point of view, they may have got more widgets done, but were they able to think out of the box? Were they able to come out with a, you know, sort of a seminal idea? I think the answer is you can't come out with seminal ideas in routine. It's not possible. Routine is not an environment conducive to out-of-the-box ideas. So the ability to sort of disassociate yourself from the mechanical part of it, having the courage to do that, to say that I don't need to appear constantly busy to remind myself that I'm a leader, or to hold my own in front of my subordinates, or more importantly, my boss. I think it requires a little bit of courage for the leader to say, it's okay, I may not appear frightfully busy, but whenever I implement something, it actually moves the needle.
And just to maybe make it real, any rituals you've seen effective leaders use to create that space for deep thought?
I think a lot of leaders now are, at least some of the people whom I know, they invest time in sports. Right. Now, it, to my mind, is a surrogate for having quality time with yourself. So when you're running, or when you're swimming, or when you are cycling, or when you're trekking, or whatever, you're actually, you're pretending to do an activity, but actually it's a very mechanical activity. So when you're swimming 50 laps, you're not looking at the scenery. You are, You're beginning that ritual and you're shutting your, dissociating your mind from your body. It's just delinking that. And the moment you delink that, your mind then starts going into directions that you have not. Some other leaders actually take up areas or reading completely disassociate, unrelated to their core subject. Or they indulge in experiences which are completely away from, sports is one, it could be arts, it could be music. I know a CEO of a firm who does metal work. You know, he actually makes metal parts. He's a mechanic, so to speak. By the way, and he's found an alternate living there because he makes customized motorcycle parts for Harley Davidson, and he's got a, you know, so you write to the guy and he'll build you a seat or whatever. And he's a CEO of a, you know, Fortune whatever company, and he does that as a hobby, or someone else does carpentering or whatever. So I think. The intent is to disassociate from your routine and go into another place. And by the way, that is the essence of all great stories. If I don't know if you've ever, you know, thought of it that way, but if you look at any great story, its essential components are there is a protagonist and there is an antagonist. And they have a first clash. And in the first clash, the antagonist always wins. And the protagonist goes away to another place. And in that place, he finds his Yoda or he finds his, guru, and he learns something there, and then he comes back and he confronts that problem and he wins. So I think this necessity of going away to another world, whether that world is a physical world or it's a metaphysical world or it's a disassociation, it's extremely important for heroes and heroines and leaders. It's extremely important.
That's a great parallel. Never thought about it that way. So Raghu, I think we've covered quite a bit of ground. In summary, this series of conversations is titled Play to Potential, which is about individuals looking at themselves, realizing the unique potential that each one of us is gifted with, and ensuring that we do the best we can to unlock that potential. So in summary, any two or three nuggets you want to leave people with for people to play to their fullest potential?
I mean, I don't know. I think I've said my piece there. If I were to sort of say certain lessons that, you know, sometimes in life there are lessons that you know, but you are unable to implement. Right. So one of the lessons I'll just share one with you and leave it at that. We all know that anything that bad happens to us, anything bad, let's say there was this teacher who was a terror for you in school and who was this larger-than-life demon and you were afraid, physically, maybe even emotionally afraid. When you look at her or him today, you laugh. And you look at that silly thing that happened, that embarrassing moment in school or in college or that moment where you thought that you should just melt and disappear into the ground. It was so bad. When you look back at it, well, you squirm a little, but you laugh about it today, right? So in other words, you know that anything that is bad that is happening today, if you just fast forward it by 6 months or 12 months, it doesn't really matter. It's no big deal. Similarly, if you look at any of your greatest moments of happiness, whatever they are, the greatest moment of joy, and if you went sufficiently back in history, you'll find the origin of that moment of joy is in a moment of tragedy. So if you're in a relationship with someone amazing, it is because you broke off from a relationship earlier. Now, if that break didn't happen, you would not be with this person, right? Or if you didn't quit that job, you wouldn't be in this place. If you were not fired from that opportunity, you would not be here, right? I think the trick, which even I haven't, I'm still, I think, some distance away from it, is while we can understand this for the past, why we can't implement it for the present and the future. So if some bad news hits me right now, why can't I just go back into my memory and say, hey, this is the beginning of something happening good. I can always advise you. but can I internalize it for myself? I think that's the journey, to start implementing the stuff that we already know. In our lives, that to my mind is the journey of your full potential. Because I don't think there are places where you need to acquire any new knowledge. Knowledge that is already in our in our soul, in our zehen, if only we are able to implement it to a better degree. You know, so I remember I used to have this chemistry teacher many, many years in school ago. And one day I was trying to faff around and say, you know, why don't we do this or why don't we do that and discover something new or whatever shit. And he just said that this electrical bulb, it is able to convert, I think, some minuscule portion of the energy into light. It's some ridiculous amount. It's like 3 or 4%. Is it? If you just triple this or double this, you would have achieved a great, you know, leap. So rather than wondering about some dramatically new skill that we need to learn, I need to learn this skill about that framework. I say, bhai, the skills that you already know theoretically and which you are able to advise other people, if you can internalize and start the 5% that you are following, if you can just make it to 10%, you have doubled your potential anyways. Rather than trying to say, you know, I need to learn one more, you know, language and one more programming code or whatever, just the knowledge that we already have in our head, if we are able to implement that to its fullest potential, I think we are, you know, we are out there anyways.
Yeah, wonderful, Raghu. On that note, it's been a really energizing conversation. Thank you for your candid and deep insights. And I truly, truly learned a lot. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Atan. Thank you.
Thank you for tuning into the third conversation of the Play to Potential podcast series. In case you're interested, the first two guests were Vijay Amritraj and Amish Tripathi. To access some of those nuggets, please visit soundcloud.com/playtopotential, or else you could follow the Twitter handle Play to Potential. Thank you for listening. Look forward to having you in one of my future conversations. Bye now.